Welcome to Misadventures in Music, after a break of about 6 weeks or so, with me, Mick Ord.
And me, Ian Prowse.
And we're going to do something different today. We're going to look back at the past year, really, Ian. We've done 13 episodes of Misadventures in Music, and I think we're quite pleased with the way it's gone, aren't we, without being too smug?
Well, I just love the fact that we can call it Season 1, and I like that they've all been put together in that way, and we can look back at the amount of fabulous people we got in to speak to and the amount of music that we covered. And it's been an adventure for myself, never mind anything else, you know.
Yeah, and it'll also give a chance for people just to, in one short sort of 20-25 minute episode, not everyone will have heard every guest that we've had. So this is a kind of look back, and then we'll also look forward to the next season as well, won't we, which will start in October.
Yeah, this is like going to be a quick greatest hits. What was my favourite moments of the season one, and what was your favourite moments?
Okay, yeah. Right, well, let's start with yours, okay, then. Go ahead.
My absolute favourite of the entire season was when we had David Fishel in. David is a Liverpool jazz player, and he's had the most fascinating life. And his story is the one that I would I'd guide anybody to who wants to listen to mine and yours podcasts. You will love it. As a listener, you will love it. There's a point in the David Fishel podcast where it explodes with laughter, because the story all comes to a point. As we delve into his life, his amazing life with Malcolm McLaren, and the story of his love life and his trip to Norway, and him being a Jewish scouser in Black Liverpool, and the whole thing comes to a point at the end, and it's my favourite moment. And I listened to it again this morning for the fourth time, and it's just joyous and really, really funny. So, yeah, David Fishel's my favourite.
How did you get to Norway?
Oh, man. I'm going to make
we're
this
We're going
brief.
Off on yet another magnificent tangent here.
Oh, man. So I'm in a studio in London.
Yeah.
And I finished my session, and I'm walking past, and another studio door was slightly ajar, and I hear this voice. Oh, my God, a female voice. So I poke my head in, and the sound engineer's got a big smile on his face, and he's recording this girl. She finishes. I said, can I stay? And he said, yeah, yeah. And she was just doing some commercials, you know, overdubs, stuff like that, backing vocals, really. Turns out this is Svetlana Plotnikova from Tashkent. But she moved to Moscow. She ran away from home. A Russian girl, a singer. She was just, anyway. So we start dating.
Okay.
And she says, you don't love me, David. And I said, I do love you, Svetlana. Why'd you say that? You don't love me. I said, why? Because you won't come to live with me. You don't invite me to live with you. And I said, baby, we've only been going out 2 months. You know, we're living with, but we can travel together. And I said, travel? What is this travel? And she said, I have seen the advert in the Melody Maker. Again, Melody Maker came into my life. For English band touring Norway. We can travel. We can join band. Then we can try to live together. We join band. We travel. So we did an audition. We got the gig. We went to Norway. On the very first gig, very posh gig, playing covers, you know, like a dance band in a very big hotel in Norway's second biggest city, Bergen. And she got jealous at the end of the gig. She thought I was paying too much attention to a female disc jockey who'd also started that night, and she was from Bristol.
Were you?
Yeah. And she said, I don't want to meet this jockey. Keep the music live. I don't like this jockey. Why you go to... I said, because she's from England. It's only polite. We go downstairs, say hello to Sarah Jane. You go. You go. I don't go. So I stayed 20 minutes. Sarah Jane bought me a beer. She said, oh, brilliant. We're going to have a month, you know, together. And the band are English. And, oh, lovely. You know. And so I get back to our little room. So now we're living together in this little room.
Svetlana.
With Svetlana.
Yeah.
She's been drinking because she's Russian.
Yes.
And so she picks up a small bottle of beer from the coffee table. She smashes it over the coffee table, runs across the room and stabs me.
No.
Yeah, man. She says, "You have been with this woman." I said, "Well, I've been 20 minutes, Svetlana. I must be a very bad lover."
Yeah.
20 minutes. Yeah. And she stabs me. She went for the jugular and I raised my arm to defend myself and it cut the nerve in my left arm.
Fuck.
Rushed
sake.
To hospital. The police were called. They said, "This is, you've been attacked." I said, "No." They said, "You have." Right. The doctors have told us this is serious. Yeah. You've been attacked. I said, "Can we say that where I come from in Liverpool, we call this a domestic incident, and that's that." And he says, "Very nice, you're trying to pretend." And one of the other girls in the band pointed at Svetlana and said, "She did it. She did it to Dave. She stabbed him."
Really?
So Svetlana
was... What damage was done to you?
It was really bad.
Was it?
Yeah. Yeah, I had to do the rest of the gig with a massive big girl.
So but you can still do the
played
gig.
With one hand with a dinner jacket, you know, tuxedo and
did
one
stitch
hand.
You up?
And, oh, God, and how. And he was a student. It was the middle of the night. And he said, "I'm a student doctor. I will do the best, Mr. Fischel, I can for you." So there's the hymn there, the police there. It was chaos. The band there, Svetlana crying her eyes. "I love you, I love you." The police gave her the option to either leave on the next plane, the very next plane back to her country of origin.
Yeah.
But she said, "I have British passport." So, okay, go back to London. Yeah. Go. Yeah. "Or you can come and sample one of our Norwegian jails here in Bergen." And I said, "Svetlana, you're going, baby. You're going. You're not staying. You have to go. You can't go to jail." "You don't love me." I said, "Svetlana, go."
Yeah.
It was serious. It was a
damn right, day. I don't love you.
I mean, we can't see the scar on this podcast. I can show you. There's still, after all this, I'm a little scar.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. And this is like the first couple of days of you being in Norway.
It was the first day, really. Yes. So I went, the contract was for a month, and I stayed 20...
Did she apologise in any way, or...?
We never... Up until many years later, we didn't have closure. She left, and that was that. I didn't want to speak to her.
Yeah,
and
you wouldn't?
She could have... It was possible.
Could have killed you.
Yeah, could have killed me, certainly could have ended career, you know, my career and all that, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I'm in London many years later, working for NRK, which is the Norwegian public broadcaster, the same as the BBC, across all media. And I was working for them in a radio capacity. They sent me to London to research jazz. NRK wanted to start a dedicated jazz channel. I'm researching it. I'm in my hotel room, and I thought, Svetlana. We never got closure. So I phoned the BBC Russian department because I knew there was a guy there, Seva Levenstein, who Svetlana knew. And I said, "Is Seva Levenstein still here?" "He runs the department. Who are you?" I said, "Put Seva on. Who are you?" I said, "Well, my name's David Fischel. I think he'll speak to me." Seva comes to the phone. He says, "Fischel, what do you do? Why you are here?" "Oh, no. You want to meet Svetlana again? Oh, no. It will be chaos again." I said, "Look, I'm not going to ask you for her phone number. Here's the hotel, the number to the hotel I'm staying in, my room number. Call her for me, please, Seva." We never got closure on this. All I want to do is say goodbye.
And how long after the stabbing incident was this?
Years.
Okay.
God, my memory's shocking. 10, 15 years? Something like that. So what happens is, about 10 minutes later, the phone goes, and it's Svetlana. "Fischl, what do you want?" She was really like that. She was hilarious, but she was very abrupt. Anyway, so we meet, and she comes to some pub near the Elephant and Castle that she's liked, and she's the same. She hasn't changed. She looks the same. She's the same character, just mad, excitingly mad.
Yeah.
Dynamic character.
Yeah.
And she's got a plastic bag with her. And so I said...
And you're ducking.
And I'm thinking, why would she bring a plastic bag?
You've got your crash helmet on.
Exactly. And I said, "What do you want? You know what I drink. Why you ask?" I said, "Well, vodka." "Two. Double, give me vodka." So I go to the bar, and by the time I come back, the two tables adjacent to her are all just in tears, in bulk. She's got the whole place laughing, and this was Svetlana.
What?
So anyway, cut a long story short.
What was in the plastic bag?
That was what I was coming to. And she pulls out Ray Charles, Through the Eyes of Love, 1972, completely out of print, that album you couldn't get. It hadn't been transferred to CD. It was one of the most influential albums in my life. Ray Charles, I love, I adore. And Through the Eyes of Love, it was just, you couldn't get this thing. I'd lent it to some friend, in inverted commas, who disappeared from London. I never got the album back. He borrowed it from me. I never got it back. She'd seen it in Camden Market. Thought, maybe one day I see Fischl again. I buy an album and I put it. Yeah, so yeah. Fischl or Lubimi, which means my loved one, or Davidka. She had all these names for me. She bought the album just on the off chance that we would actually meet again. No. That was what was in the plastic bag. She gave me the album.
Oh. Was she still holding a candle for you then, do you think?
No, she'd...
She wasn't holding a bottle.
Yeah. She was living with somebody at the time, and that was the last we ever spoke.
Was it?
Yeah, it was beautiful. A hug, and that was it. We got the closure we both felt we needed.
So you forgive her for...
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
Oh, David, you're too nice.
What a life you've had, mate.
Man, she gave me a lot.
Yeah. Did you get it on with the girl from Bristol then, or...?
Yeah.
One of the most amazing things about David's story is how Bow Wow Wow the band came into being, viewed through the prism of the modern era. It's incredibly dodgy as well. So this is Bow Wow Wow.
I don't like you. I don't like you, town. I don't want to like you. I'll shop around. I don't want you. I don't want you, town. I don't want to want you. I'll shop around. I'll shop around. I can get a train. I don't need no hamburgers, no takeaway. I want my own game. No bacon take, no strawberry milkshake. I want a picnic. I'm sick, sick of seeing signs to eat, walking down these dark, lonely streets. I don't know you. I don't know you, town. I don't want to know you. I'll shop around. I'll shop around. I can get a train. I don't need no hamburgers, no takeaway. I want my own game. No bacon take, no strawberry milkshake.
That record, doesn't it? Still works, that song. It's still got the vibrancy and the kind of knockabout quality that was so emblematic of that era in music.
Yeah, and with what we know, you can hear Malcolm McLaren all over it in a way that I couldn't when it came out, you know. And all of the dodgy things that David speaks about, you can hear it all in there, you know. Wild record.
Talking about wild... one of our earlier podcasts was about the Shane McGowan film, Crock of Gold, A Few Rounds with Shane McGowan. Now, you really weren't that enamoured of the film, were you?
No, I thought it was poor. When you consider the greatness of Shane McGowan, I think that the film was like just haphazard, and it really didn't get to the core of why he's great. It was Julian Temple, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, the guy who did the Sex Pistols film and many, many others.
Yeah, and I think artistically it fell short of what it should have. Now, I don't know if that was because of Shane himself was difficult to work with, but when you see the trailer for the film with all that footage of Shane McGowan outside Buckingham Palace and the early punk rock gigs and the ear being bitten off and all that stuff, and the Pogues at their height in New York City, you think to yourself, this is going to be the best rock and roll documentary ever. But actually, when you watch it, it's a disappointment.
I probably liked it a bit better than you.
Yeah.
Because although I knew about him, I didn't kind of know the full journey. I mean, he's an amazing guy, but he hasn't produced anything for a long, long time, has he? And that's a terrible shame for us. Yeah. It might be fine for him, I guess.
Yeah. He's not an artistic going concern, is he? He's kind of, you know, he'll be relying wherever he lives, whatever he does with his life, he's basically relying on kind of royalties and whatever, which is a real shame. It's as if, you know, he's destroyed himself. And it would be lovely if he could do some new music and, you know, some new comments upon who he is and where he is in the world right now. But I don't think we're going to get that out of him. So.
No, but one of the good things that I was pleased about with the Shane McGowan episode, that we managed to get an interview with Siobhan McAndrew, who worked on the film, and she really did give some fascinating insights into what it's like to work with Shane.
Yeah. Well, she slags him. You know, she shoots from the hip. She tells him what it's really like. And basically, I don't think she'd work with him again by the sounds of it. She didn't mind when you'd interviewed her telling it straight how it was. So that's, I think that really got our podcast off to a great, great start when we realised we could get content as good as that from behind the scenes. You know, it's still one of my favourite moments.
I was lucky in that Shane took a shining to me, I suppose, for whatever reason. I think with me being kind of the younger one working on the film, and also just having a genuine and keen interest in his music. I mean, there was one stage where he was refusing to come to the location to film. And because at that particular time, you know, I was seen as kind of one of the members of the team that he would, I suppose, have a bit of time for. I was, you know, taxied from Kildare to Balls Bridge in Dublin, where he lives, with the mission to kind of coax him out of his house to come down for this shoot that we had planned. You know, we'd gone to a lot of trouble of setting up this beautiful shoot, and it was actually at the Marina Guinness's house, Marina Guinness of the Guinness family. The gorgeous house out in Kildare, and we had a fire lit and a big campfire, and you know, we had musicians there and everything looked beautiful, and all we needed was for Shane to turn up, and he'd promised he would come, and we'd organized transport and everything. And I was then sent with one of the producers to kind of go over to Shane's house and try and convince him really to get into the van and come to the location. And I must have been in the house for well over an hour, even though I failed in my mission. I mean, I left the house without Shane. We still had the most wonderful chats, and fair play to his wife, Victoria, because little did I know she had set up a video. She had been filming it, the whole encounter, on her iPhone, and she later WhatsApped it to me. And it's of me and Shane having this discussion about the music of Phil Lynott and Thin Lizzy. I know some people would say Phil Lynott, but for the purpose of this call, I'm going to say Phil Lynott, because many Irish people would still pronounce it Lynott, even though the man himself would say Lynott. And we were talking about the early Lizzy records, in particular, you know, their debut album, and then Shades of a Blue Orphanage. And I've got that album cover or the logo tattooed on my wrist. So I was showing that to Shane, and he just broke out into song, and he started singing Little Girl in Bloom to me. And he remembered every lyric word for word, like word perfect. And he then took out his wrist and showed me this chain that he was wearing. And lo and behold, it was Phil Lynott's chain. It's the one he wears, I think, on the cover of Live and Dangerous.
Wow.
And Phil Lynott had gifted that to Shane. And that was a really special moment for me, because I'm a huge Thin Lizzy fan and a huge Shane fan, and kind of these two worlds colliding. And I didn't know that the camera was rolling at the time, but I don't know if I'll ever post that video, but I will cherish it forever because it shows the real Shane. You know, he was so kind and warm and kind of giving with his time, you know, a generosity of spirit. You know, you hear this phrase, but that kind of sums him up. Like, he's very generous when it comes to teaching people things, and he loves discussing, you know, Irish history, Irish music, books. You know, he's a big fan of nature documentaries, for instance. You know, he has lots of interests, and if you get him on his own, he's more likely to be himself, I suppose, like many of us. And then when you're surrounded by crew and fellow celebrities, the bravado and the ego come out. So there was definitely two personalities we were kind of grappling with. It was like, oh, what version of Shane are we going to get today?
McCormick and Richard Tauber are singing by the bed. There's a glass of punch below your feet and an angel at your head. There's devils on each side of you with bottles in their hand. You need one more drop of poison and you'll dream of foreign lands. When you pissed yourself in Frankfurt and got sipped down in Cologne, and you're at the rattling deck trains as you lay there all alone. Frank Ryan bought you whiskey in a brothel in Madrid, and you text some fucking black shirt who was cursing all the yids. And a sick bit of Coop Cullen will kneel and say a prayer, but the ghosts are rattling at the door and the devil's in the chair. The Euston Tavern, you screamed it was your shell, but they wouldn't give you service, so you kicked the windows out. They took you out in Turner Street, kicked you in the brains, so you went back in through a bolted door and did it all again. And a sick bit of Coot Cullen will kneel and say a prayer, and the ghosts are rattling at the door and the devil's in the chair. Hey! Remember that foul evening when you heard the banshees howl? There was lazy, drunken bastards singing Billy in the Bell. They took you up to midnight mass and left you in the lurch. So you dropped a button in the plate and spewed up in the church. Now you sing a song of liberty for blacks and packs of jocks, and I'll take you from this dump you're in and stick you in a box. Then I'll take you to Cook Prior and shove you in the ground, where you stick your head back out and shout, we'll have another round. At the gravesite of Cook Cullen, we'll kneel around and cry, and God is in his heaven, and Billy's down by the bay.
Say what you like about Shane or the documentary, but that's just genius, isn't it? As Bruce Springsteen says, they won't be listening to us in hundreds of years, but they'll definitely be listening to Shane, you know. So there you go.
Right, your next fave is it's actually about a guy that you didn't know, did you? You'd never heard of him before.
No.
Before we did the podcast on him.
No, this is, we managed to get in Jed, who did the BBC documentary about Lindisfarne and the music of Alan Hull, and which I didn't know anything about. I'd obviously heard of Lindisfarne, and I just kind of thought they were a bit of a novelty band with Fog on the Tyne. I never realised about how ingrained they were in Geordie culture and the Newcastle community. And the journey that I personally went on off the back of Jed's wonderful documentary was just great, because the sense of time and place that Alan Hull had with Newcastle. I feel an empathy with that, with this area here in Liverpool. And also the strength of his singing and his music is fantastic. So to get Jed in, who actually made that BBC documentary, was just what a highlight for us.
Well, Jed Clark, who actually lives in Liverpool, this was a labour of love for him for about 5 years. I spoke to him years ago and he said, I want to do a music documentary about the Geordie Bob Dylan, the Geordie Dylan.
Yeah.
And that's how Jed sees him. And that love came over in the documentary with some great archive material from the early 70s from Newcastle, wasn't it?
Well, he'd had the idea for about 20 years, hadn't he? And it wasn't until Sam Fender mentioned Lindisfarne that he saw a huge in. Let's get Sam Fender to narrate over this, you know, fellow Geordie Idols documentary. And at that point, I think it was the BBC, the door opened. So the door had always been closed, you know, it's a good idea, but we're not going to go for it. Get the contemporary young superstar in of Sam Fender. All of a sudden, it all made sense, and Jed managed to finally get the documentary made. So we got to discuss that entire process with Jed, you know, which must have been years and years of frustration for him, really. So, and it's so, the documentary is just a wonderful watch if you've never seen it.
And you can still watch it on BBC iPlayer, I think.
Yeah, so watch the documentary and then listen to our podcast of the guy who made it. You know, what an honour for me and you to get that.
Yeah, it's been a long road, but I mean, and the dilemma is, I mean, we wanted to make a film to tell people that this is an unforgotten hero, and really he should be much lauded, and he's not, and that was the thrust. But people are saying, don't really want to know, do it, because I don't know who he is, you know, and that's the whole point. You don't know who he is, but he's brilliant, you know. And we had to coax out all these stars who just say, well, they didn't take any coaxing, actually. All these big names said, I'll talk about him, he's brilliant.
I mean, you got Sting, Elvis Costello, Dave Stewart,
Peter Gabriel, Mark Knopfler.
How did you get them?
Just rang them up.
And clearly, as simple as that.
No, well, I was very fortunate in that my associate producer was Ray Laidlaw, who was the drummer, the original drummer in Lindisfarne.
Right.
And the drummer in Lindisfarne forever. He's a great guy, knows everybody, knows the music business really well. We sat down and said, let's do this, we've got to do it, make it happen. That was 4 years ago. I said, what we need is a calling card, let's make a little trailer about it. Who can we get? And he said, well, I can get Sting. And I said, can you? So he just emailed Sting and he said, yeah, I'll do it. And then I said, oh, well, if we've got Sting, we can now tell people Sting's doing it, so can you join us? And we emailed Elvis Costello's people and Peter Gabriel's people, and they both came straight back and said, yeah.
Fantastic.
Because we knew, we'd read stuff about them saying Alan Hull was great, he should be recognised, and they were singing off the same hymn sheet as we were. So,
oh, well done, because for people that don't know, getting that kind of documentary on the TV, particularly the BBC...
Well, actually, it wasn't. We got the trailer made, but that was only half of it, because we still couldn't get a commission.
Yeah.
And even though we had those names, we thought, my God, what we got to do?
Yeah.
And then last, well, say 2020 it was, Sam Fender released Winter Song, one of Alan's great songs. And he did it as a sort of a charity single for the homeless in the northeast, in Newcastle, because that's what it's about, basically. We were thrilled. Because suddenly Alan was getting mentioned, because it said, where did this song come from, Sam? And he said, oh, it's Lindisfarne, man. And then it just went from there. And we'd already approached Sam, because Ray knows him, of course. He knows everybody up there. He was going to do an interview if we got the documentary. But then we just thought, let's ask Sam to front this. And it might just open a door or two. And I think that was the clincher, really.
Oh, nice one.
Because you've suddenly got a whole new audience. He's a very happening guy. He's a brilliant talent as well.
Yeah.
And he genuinely likes his music. He likes that. He didn't know enough, but he knew he was a Geordie legend. And he as a kid, he used to go to open mic nights and play Lady Eleanor. So
wonderful. Ian is bursting to ask you loads of questions. Can I just ask you to rewind? We played Lady Eleanor at the beginning, and until I did a bit of research on this, I had no idea what that song was about, and I misheard a lot of it. Will you fill us in on that?
Well, it's a beautiful song, as you say, and it's very hard to categorise, but he mentions In Walked Roderick Usher, And anyone who's read a few books might know that Edgar Allan Poe did a short story called The Fall of the House of Usher, which is about a man called Roderick Usher. And Allan, at one period in the late 60s, worked at a psychiatric hospital in Gosforth in Newcastle, St. Nicholas's. He was just perfect for the job, apparently. He just looked after the patients really well, and he used to take them out, the ones who were allowed out during the day, and take them down the pub, which was very Allan. But apparently, when he was on night shift, he just read voraciously, and Edgar Allan Poe was one of his things, and he just was inspired by that story to write this sort of fantastic sort of metaphysical sort of song. But there's another thing. You see, this, as you'll know, the songs aren't just made on the spot by one thought. We were talking to Alan's best friend, Terry Morgan, who he grew up with, went to school with. And Terry said when they lived in Lowfell in Gateshead, there was this cut they used to take to go down to the pub, and they used to call it the Dingley Dell. And then, hey, there was an album coming in a few years down the line. But there was a statue of a beautiful woman in this Dingley Dell, and Alan used to call her his Lady Eleanor. Now, and this is obviously something in his head, yeah. And then it just all adds up, and, yeah. And he writes a song like that.
Yeah.
I gaze with troubled vision on an awful poster bed, where Eleanor had risen to kiss the neck below my head and bid me come along with her to the land of the dancing dead. But it's all right, Lady Eleanor. Like a mother to a son, like living, dying, seeing, being all rolled into one. And all at once I heard some music playing in my bones, the same old song I'd heard for years reminding me of home. But it's all right, Lady Eleanor. And beast desire. And when it seemed for certain that the screams could get no higher, I heard a voice above the rest screaming, "You're a liar." But it's all right, Lady Eleanor.
Was Lindisfarne and Lady Eleanor on the back of our interview with Jed Clark, the guy who made the documentary about Alan Hull. As Ian said before, well worth Well worth watching.
Amazing singing. What a great singer. Yeah.
Have you have genuinely listened to his stuff since that?
Yeah, I have, because there's so many things that resonate with me. He's got such a sense of his time and his place, and also of his class. Yeah. You know, a lot of his later stuff, he got really, really political. So that really, that ticks all of my boxes. So I feel a great empathy with him. And he also liked a bevy as well. So, you know, and that makes the world go round, sitting in the pub talking rubbish. So there you go.
Now, we did a couple of our early episodes. We did one on women who changed musical direction. And we did one on men as well. And the track we're going to play soon. I saw your jaw drop a couple of times at the end of it. But Scott Walker,
yeah.
I've only kind of in the past couple of years began to appreciate his later stuff. Because he was a pop idol in the 60s. Tall, good-looking, blonde American guy. Ballads, deep baritone voice. Did you know any of his later stuff at all?
I didn't know anything. I only know like the hits, you know. And when you brought this in as your example of somebody who's changed direction, I realised that it's very easy for bands to be shocking, but it's not easy for bands to be frightening. And this track is frightening. I remember you saying to me, I can only play it once a year because it holds within it. You know, it's really unnerving.
It is, isn't it? And it's not often you can say that about music, is it? You know, I mean, Scott's change of direction didn't just happen overnight. It happened over sort of 10 or 15 years. He made a sort of comeback in the late 70s and early 80s. Yeah. And then his music got progressively more challenging, shall we say. The first time I heard the track we're going to play shortly, The Escape, my God, I had to turn the lights on. I think I was listening in bed on my old Sony Walkman or whatever it was, and my word, I had to turn the lights on again. It's an interesting backstory. I think it does help to put it into context. So the tone is kind of like a dreamlike state, I suppose you'd say. It's about a witness to a car bombing in the Middle East. And the song is written from the perspective of a Jewish rabbi witnessing the car moving along the road. It is scary stuff.
The car in front follows the long way around. Grey moons, predator moons. You and me against the world. You and me against the world. It will look into your eyes.
What you do?
That's the second time you've made me listen to that, Michael, in a year. And I think I'll leave it for another 5 or 6 years now before I ever hear that again. What a wild piece of art that is.
Yeah. And a lot of his later stuff, a lot of Scott Walker's later stuff, has a film-like quality to it. You can imagine him writing them for films, which he did write music for films.
And so far away from what we know him for. Which is that was the point of that whole podcast. And I think this is what we do when we have our chats. We go to places that other talks don't really go to. So I think that's why, this is one of your favourites, isn't it? That we managed to go there with that. Where else would people talk about songs like this,
Well, hopefully when we start the next series in October, we're going to be looking at a whole range of new topics and artists. One in particular I'm looking forward to, and I know you'll be looking forward to it, is a mate of mine who lives in New Jersey now. And he's in the process of making a film. And this is a long-term project. He's been on it for a couple of years, about post-punk. So we'll be speaking to Russell Richardson home, and you will love him. He's a really good guy, and got some interesting thoughts about the post-punk era in the UK.
Well, a fascinating era, and huge here in Liverpool, obviously, with Echo and the Bunnymen being the forefront of the post-punk thing. And just for me and my generation, I could talk post-punk all day long, so I'm really looking forward to meeting him.
And we're looking forward to the new series of Misadventures in Music, which will start in October.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at what we did, we got Malik in to talk about... He was so close to Gil Scott-Heron, so we got to talk about Gil a lot. And Paul in to talk about the Viper label and so many other things that you managed to get so many great guests in. So season one was just a joy to do. And I can't wait for season two, because I know you've got some other classic ones waiting for us.